Chapter 8. The Chemic Spheres. Arx Angelicum, Baal. Antros thought that this time he might have the chance to explore the diurnal vault in more detail, but Rasselas did not give him time to pause. The librarian had barely spoken as he led him from the orbicular tower, marching purposely through the endless dusk of the librarium to Mephiston's private chambers. After approaching the star-fueled colossus at the centre of the vaults, the black and crimson statue of the angel, Rasselas had led Antros between its feet, down past rows of sentries and gun servitors, into a series of subterranean passageways. The damp, mossy crypts looked to be as old as the undercroft beneath the Carceri Arcanum, and the architecture was of a similar style, but Antros had never seen this particular corner of the librarium before. As Rasselas led him deeper beneath the ground, the air grew oddly humid, and water began to drip from Antros's battle plate, edging the greaves and vambraces with droplets that glinted in the torchlight. As the chambers grew darker and warmer, Antros realized that they were alone. No sentries watched over the thick, rock-crete doors, but they were guarded in other ways. At each doorway, Rasselas mouthed a few silent words, and drew in the air with his finger. As he did, a glowing rune appeared in the centre of the door, and it slid open with a hiss of hydraulics. They reached a stone door that was larger and more ornate than the previous ones. It looked to be even more ancient than the surrounding crypts. The images sculpted into the marble had been rendered indistinct by countless years of erosion. Only one aspect of its design had survived. At its centre were two characters, I, X. Standing on either side of the door was a black-robed figure. They were giants, as tall as Antros and Rasselas, and it was clear from their hulking, inhuman frames that they were Adeptus Astartes. They wore no armour, but their hands were resting on the winged pommels of huge, two-handed swords, the blades of which were planted in the ground between their feet. Their heads were bowed, but Antros caught a flash of metal in their deep hoods and realized they were wearing gold masks. Rasselas paid them no heed, placing his palm on the two numerals sculpted in the center of the door. The door swung back with a groan of hinges, and light flooded out to greet them. They walked on, past the sentries, and, as he passed by, Antros had the odd sensation that their heads were swiveling, owl-like behind their gold masks, watching him as he passed. He looked back and saw that their heads had not moved, but he could not rid himself of the idea.
"The chemic spheres," said Rasselas, calling Antros's thoughts back to the blinding light ahead of them.
Before them was an ivory dome, caged by elegant golden struts and buttresses. It burned with the power of the star trapped in the vaults above. There were rune-inscribed cables embedded in the girders, feeding Idalia's furious energy down into the dome's walls. The ivory surface was opaque, so we could see nothing within it, and it shone so brightly that he could not see what surrounded it.
"What is this?" asked Antros, impressed by the majesty of the structure.
"A prison," replied Rasselas. "A prison within prisons. Strong enough to contain the chapter's most dangerous weapon."
He looked hard at Antros.
"It takes the power of a sun to contain the soul incarcerated here."
Antros felt another rush of excitement. How many other Lexicani had been here? He looked around at Rasselas, but the old warrior ignored him, scratching his iron-grey beard thoughtfully as he studied the curved ivory wall before them. This close, Antros could see that the surface was not as featureless as it first appeared, but engraved with an intricate pattern of tiny numbers. Rasselas unclipped a glass syringe from his armour. It was full of crimson liquid, and as Rasselas held it up into the sphere's light, Antros saw shapes suspended in it. He watched, fascinated, as Rasselas pushed the needle into the wall of the sphere. The surface gave a little, as though it were flesh rather than ivory, and Rasselas slowly injected the red liquid. At first, nothing happened. Antros was just about to ask for an explanation when a web of thin red lines spread out from the needle tip.
The crimson tracery crawled and trickled, like paint blown by a child. As the lines rippled over the ivory, they formed a blood-red rectangle, several feet taller than the two librarians.
"You remember what I said?"
asked Rasilus, glaring at Antros.
"Of course," replied Antros,
but he was only half listening. He was focusing all of his thoughts on the dazzling sphere, trying furiously to see a glimpse of what lay beyond the red door. His mind touched on something that made him recoil. He felt, rather than saw, a snapshot of horrific violence. Rasilus looked at him in surprise.
"You saw something?"
Antros shook his head.
"Just a feeling," he muttered.
Rasilus was clearly puzzled, but said no more, returning his attention to the doorway. He muttered a string of words, but Antros only caught two of them. It sounded like dark air, or dark air. Then Rasilus gave Antros a brief nod, withdrew the needle, and stepped into the crimson portal, vanishing from view. Antros followed, his hands raised before him, expecting to slam against the wall of the sphere. He did not, and found himself in near total darkness. The only light came from Rasilus's warp-tinted eyes as he turned to face Antros.
"Remember,"
he said, before muttering another series of words and vanishing from view for a second time. Antros stepped after him, then halted, blinded by light and noise. He crouched low, drawing his pistol. He and Rasilus were standing on the ruins of a colossal imperial building. Flames and smoke covered shattered parapets, and the ground was shaking as though the world were in the grip of a violent fever. There was a dull hammer blow of artillery impacts, and the chemical sky was slashed into strange geometry by rocket trails and lines of tracer fire. Beyond the ruins, there was a great mountain of flame rolling majestically across. Rasilus laughed.
"No need for that,"
he said, nodding at Antros's pistol.
"We are neither here nor then."
He clambered over the face of a decapitated statue and waved for Antros to follow. Despite Rasilus's words, Antros could not help flinching as ordnance pounded and cracked all around him. A shell landed nearby, obliterating a grand archway and hurling debris in all directions. Antros held his hands before his face as a tank-sized piece of rubble flew towards him. The masonry passed straight through him and crashed down several feet away. He looked down at his battle plate and saw it was unmarked. Intrigued, he tried pushing his foot through the rocks he was standing on and found that he could. His boot passed through the ground like water. He was an apparition.
"The illusion mirrors real-world physics," explained Rasilus, as he continued climbing across the ruins. "It's easier for your mind to cope with it this way. We could just as easily swim through these stones, but our minds have an annoying fondness for the inconveniences of the materium. So they let us think we need to crawl and clamber through a real Hades hive."
"Hades hive?" exclaimed Antros, looking up at the shattered spires that surrounded them.
He suddenly recognized the ruins that were silhouetted against the war-torn sky. The wars for Armageddon were legendary for their brutality, and Hades' Hive in particular had great significance for the Blood Angels chapter.
"Why are we at Hades' Hive?" he cried, struggling to be heard over the explosions and clatter of collapsing walls.
"Listen, neophyte," replied Rasilus, as Antros hurried to catch up with him. "I told you we are not there or then. We are on Baal, beneath the diurnal vault, shouting like idiots into the silence of the chemic spheres."
They crested a fallen buttress and found a bloodbath. Scattered in a crater below them were the corpses of dozens of Xenos monsters. Massive, brutish greenskins, clad in crudely wrought plates of armour and clutching a scrapyard of jerry-built weapons. Their low-slung heads had a boar-like bestiality, and their enormous jaws were crammed with tusks. If any of them had been alive, they would have made a terrifying sight. As it was, they were gutted and bleeding, gathering flies as their spilled viscera slowly baked in the sun. Sitting on a toppled pillar, clutching one of the greenskin's hearts, was a peculiar sight. It was a blood angel, dressed in the black of the Death Company. The ceremonial armour, daubed with a red X, clearly marked him out as one of those brave brothers who had lost his mind to the gene curse. The berserkers of the Death Company could only serve the chapter by making their deaths as costly as possible. Sitting calmly on a rock was not possible for such damned souls. They raged, screamed and killed until they made their final sacrifice. Then Antros felt a flood of understanding as he saw the Blood Angel's face. It was Mephiston. But Mephiston, as he must once have been, as physically perfect as any other Blood Angel. "Calastarius," muttered Antros. This was the moment of Mephiston's rebirth. From his vantage point on the buttress, Antros could see dozens more greenskins loping through the ruins towards the spot where Calastarius was seated. He was about to call out when Racilus placed a hand on his arm and shook his head.
"Remember your training, Lexicanium," he said, nodding to the pouches at Antros's belt. "Record and illuminate, brother. Record and illuminate."
Antros shook his head, confused. The whole situation was surreal, but he did as he was ordered, taking out his mnemonic stylus and tablet and beginning to take notes.
"You said this was a prison," he said, whispering, even though he knew the greenskins could not hear him.
Racilus nodded.
"Mephiston created the chemic spheres to imprison our most dangerous weapon, himself. He needed a safe place to explore what he is."
"What he is?"
Antros was struggling to follow. Racilus nodded at the approaching greenskins.
"Watch and record. Talk later."
He tried not to react, as the greenskins picked up their pace, smelling the presence of Calastarius. They swaggered across the rubble, hulking and ape-like as they belched out commands in the disgusting guttural language of their kind. The leader was a head taller than the others and clad in a full bodysuit of rusting, jagged metal. Even its enormous head was hidden inside a grill-fronted helmet, hammered together from mismatched plates of armour. It looked more machine than orc, splintering slabs of rockcrete under its square metal boots as it smashed through walls and piles of razor wire. A flame gun was fixed to its left arm, dripping promethium, and the other arm ended in a giant mechanized claw. At the sight of Calastarius, it bellowed with pleasure, pointed its flamer at him, and turned the crater into a lake of fire. When the flames cleared, Calastarius was still seated, calmly studying the now blackened heart he was holding. He glanced up at the circle of greenskins that were forming around him, but showed no sign of lifting the force sword that was lying across his lap. The leader of the greenskins raised its metal claw and roared again, spraying blood and spit through the mesh of its helmet. The rest of the greenskins swept forwards, flooding the crater with their armor-clad bulk. At the last possible moment, Calastarius stood and stepped to one side, swinging his sword as he moved and decapitating the first orc to reach him. The movement was so easy and fluid that it seemed more like dancing than fighting. The now headless monster crashed into the wall of the crater, tearing away another hunk of granite. The orcs tried to correct their charge, but several of them slammed into the spot that Calastarius had just vacated, and the rest of them howled in frustration as they saw that he had moved again. Calastarius had bounded over a series of burned-out tank chassis and leapt at the orcs' leader. The monster tried to spin and face him, but its heavy armor made it slow, and before it could aim its weapon, Calastarius dropped from the sky and hammered his sword blade down through the grill of its helmet. As the blade struck home, it erupted into crimson fire, and the orc's head detonated in a plume of blood mist. As the creature collapsed to the ground, Calastarius pulled his sparking sword free, placed his boot on the orc's corpse, and used it as a springboard for another leap. As he passed over the heads of the mob below, they loosed a barrage of gunfire, but Calastarius merged with the ceiling of black fumes and vanished from sight, before reappearing back on the rock where he had started.
"There are too many," hissed Antros, drawing Rasilus's attention to the huge mobs of greenskins that were now rushing towards the crater, drawn by the flames and gunfire.
"That's the point," replied Rasilus, nodding at Antros's stylus. "Record and illuminate."
Antros looked back to the crater and saw that Calistarius was now standing on the broken pillar, his sword raised and his plasma pistol drawn in readiness as the waves of orcs charged. Lines of blue plasma cut through the smoke, slamming into the heavily armoured orcs and sending them sprawling onto their backs. Calistarius fired with preternatural speed, filling the crater with light and broken bodies. The orcs crashed over the lip of the crater in ever greater numbers, crushing each other in their kill frenzy. And, finally, Calistarius's pistol sparked and died, overheated by such a furious barrage of shots. He hurled it aside and stepped casually forwards to meet them with his blade, slashing, thrusting and parrying with such languid ease that he might have been back on Baal in a training cage. By now, the crater was heaped with greenskin dead, and they were gradually forcing Calistarius back with their sheer numbers, grunting and roaring as they tried to bring him down. Still showing no sign of alarm, Calistarius took a step back, grabbed his sword in both hands, and stabbed the flaming blade down into the ground. Lines of fire splayed out beneath the orc's feet, and, with a series of moist tearing sounds, their bodies began to burst open, exploding in a shower of boiling blood. The spitting, steaming liquid filled the air as row after row of the greenskins exploded inside their plate armour. All the greenskins near to Calistarius collapsed in ruptured mounds, adding to the heaps of dead. Calistarius wrenched his force sword free and waded through the gore towards the survivors.
"Rasilus!" hissed Antros, as he saw what Calistarius could not.
As Mephiston prepared to finish off the rest of the orcs, one of the fallen orcs behind had risen from the corpses and aimed an odd-looking pistol at him. Rasilus shook his head, so Antros watched in impotent horror as the pistol flashed blue and fired. Calistarius had already begun killing the rest of the orcs, but he seemed to sense the shot before it was fired, dodging to one side. His foresight stopped the blow taking his head off, but it still impacted with his shoulder with a fierce blue flash, hurling him through the air and slamming him onto the base of a toppled pillar. He reached out towards the orc with his fingers splayed, and the monster arched in pain before collapsing into a sack of broken bones and pulverized flesh. Another orc had taken advantage of the distraction to fire at Calistarius, this time with a big, two-handed rocket launcher. To fire a weapon like that at such short range was nothing short of suicidal. The crater vanished in a column of dust and whistling shrapnel. When the dust cleared, Antros saw that Calistarius had been crushed into the masonry, like a toy pressed into wet clay. His black armour was glowing, with embers and scorch marks, and his force sword had been warped out of shape, the blade twisted into a useless mass of blunted metal. Calistarius wrenched himself out of the rock and shook the dust from his face. The light show had drawn an even bigger crowd. Hundreds of greenskins were now gathering around the crater, grinning with their huge, tusk-crammed jaws and training a forest of guns on the dust-shrouded space marine below them. Calistarius paused in shock, not at the numbers of greenskins, but at the sight of his ruined sword. Antros gasped in pain, as his head filled with unbelievable rage. Rasilus grabbed him before he fell, staring at him.
"What?"
he started to ask, but at that moment, a deafening howl tore through the air, drowning out even the sound of artillery and aircraft. The ruins fell into shadow, as though something had passed in front of the sun, and Antros looked down into the crater to see that the sound was coming from Calistarius. Just as he had seen on Thermia 5, Calistarius had been transformed by an uncontrollable rage. He raised his hands towards the sky as though beseeching the clouds for aid, howling all the while. All Antros could do was watch in awe as the heavens responded to Calistarius's summons. The wheeling, toxic clouds overhead formed into mountainous shards of grey rock and then dropped from the sky. Antros shielded his face as the colossal spearhead slammed into the ruined city. They hit with a seismic impact, collapsing the few remaining towers and sending up new mountains of dust and fire. Antros climbed the wing of a broken statue and looked out over Hades Hive. Much of the view was obscured by the plumes of dust and smoke, but in the gaps, he saw that, in every direction, the rain of mountains was obliterating the orc clans. The blows were not discriminating between orc and human, though. He saw entire columns of imperial armour vanish beneath the falling rocks, and squadrons of Stormraven gunships smashed from the air. As this atrocity grew in fury, Calistarius's roar grew louder. There was now a note of horror mixed in with the rage, and as Calistarius howled at the boiling sky, Antros felt alien thoughts blossoming in his mind. It was Calistarius's agony.
"Now!" said a voice in his head. "Now!"
The noises inside Antros's head merged with the cacophony outside, until he could take no more. He joined his howl to Calistarius's. Then, as suddenly as it arrived, the scene was gone. Antros stumbled, fell to the floor, and saw that he was back in the chemic spheres. Nothing of the crypt beyond was visible. He was inside the ivory dome. Except it was no longer ivory. The intricate network of red lines had now crisscrossed the entire sphere, and it was dripping constantly, so that as Antros looked up, a fine crimson rain washed over his face, and he had to blink away the blood to see. Opposite him was Mephiston. He was sitting in a tall brass chair, engraved with thousands of tiny cartouches. His face was haggard and cadaverous once more, and he was dressed in his usual crimson armour and robes. One of the syringes had been removed from his armour, and it lay at his feet as he stared up at the ceiling of the sphere. The glass barrel was empty. Mephiston's eyes had rolled back in their sockets, and he was slumped in the chair like a corpse. Antros thought the chief librarian might be dead. He was drenched in the blood that was falling over everything, slapping in thick droplets on the gleaming white floor.
"Chief librarian!"
cried Antros, climbing to his feet. A hand on his shoulder halted him. The veteran librarian nodded to the other side of the sphere. As Antros looked, a second brass chair materialized from the air, covered in the same strange symbols as the first. As it formed from the ether, a complicated tracery of glyphs, lines and numbers spread across the floor, as though drawn in the blood by an invisible scribe. A crimson spiderweb linking the two chairs. Antros noticed that, as he walked, the crimson symbols on the floor morphed and flowed around his footfalls, redrawing their shapes in response to his steps. Raceless walked in the opposite direction and sat on a third brass chair that materialized to greet him. A complex network of red lines and ellipses now covered the floor, linking the three chairs as if they were celestial bodies in a star chart. Antros and Raceless sat in silence, watching the slumped figure of their chief librarian. The only sound came from the blood rain, splashing crimson stars across the dazzling floor. Antros was about to speak when a torrent of images flooded his mind. He saw Hades Hive again, but this time he was pinned beneath a huge weight, unable to move, despite an incredible fury pounding through his veins. It was agony, but Antros sensed that he was now seeing the truth.
"It is always the same and always different,"
said Mephiston in his head. Antros looked over at the chief librarian, but he was still insensate.
"Always Armageddon. But each time I try to discover the meaning of my powers, changing the details, searching for the truth of my birth, the truth of my nature."
"I do not understand," said Antros.
"Yes, you do, Lexicanium. We have nobility in our blood, such nobility. The blood of the angel, divinity, filling our hearts, swelling our veins. Our father was the Emperor's purest son, and we carry his bloodline still. I know you feel it, Lexicanium. The faith and the fury, the honour and the hunger, burning within you, as it does in all of the angel sons.
The dome's walls parted to reveal a wall of blood-filled eyes, dozens of them, all staring at him.
Apart from me, of course. I have escaped the curse. The tales are true. However furious the fight, the usual hunger does not haunt me. My heart no longer pounds with those terrible lusts. I have escaped the doom of our chapter. I am unfettered, free, to finally prove our nobility. I have the power to avert the grim fate that hangs over us. This slow, gnawing decline, this gradual death.
The eyes closed, and the walls became a featureless white once more, and the grotesque images vanished. The scenes of destruction filled Antros's mind again, showing him the ruins of Hades' hive.
And yet, I return here, faithful as the tide, endlessly rewriting the moment of my deathbirth. You see, I have escaped one curse, only to discover another, far crueler torment. What you saw on Thermia is an echo of that first slaughter on Hades' hive. But instead of fading, the echo grows louder with every repeat. Every time I give vent to my power, it becomes wilder, more dangerous, more unstoppable. At first I can use it as a weapon, but the weapon becomes the wielder, and when I am myself again, I recall nothing of the excesses it has driven me to. All I know is the carnage I have wrought.
There was a clatter of ceramite as Mephiston sat up in his chair. His face was freckled with blood spots, and his hair was plastered across his clammy skin.
"But I have to control it, Lexicanium," he said, speaking out loud. "If I can find an anchor for the power that is growing in me, I will be the living embodiment of what a blood angel can be. I will be proof that we can finally escape this curse. Do you understand? If I can master this gift, I can save us. There is no power in the warp equal to the strength that has been given to me. It is like none of the disciplines we strive to master through learning. It is not practiced. It is not studied. It is wild, glorious. It is the blood of Sanguinius Unbound. It is the power of a..."
His words faltered, and he looked at the blood-splattered floor.
"I am so close to fulfilling the destiny that the angel was robbed of. But if I cannot harness this, if I cannot control this power, if it keeps growing in fury and I find no leash..."
He shook his head, and his voice was full of pain.
"Then it would be better that I died as Calistarius, under those rocks. Rather than save us, I will be the final death knell for the sons of the angel."
Mephiston fell silent, and after a while, Racilus spoke up. He saw the surprise in Antros's face, and his usual sardonic tone was absent.
"For decades, I have watched over the chief librarian in this hidden chamber, witnessing his agony as he pushes himself again and again to the edge of destruction, attempting to divine the key to this gift."
He rose from his chair and crossed the room, covering the floor with a new explosion of bloody sigils.
"But we have failed every time."
As Racilus reached the wall of the sphere, a brass plinth, as high as his waist, materialized from the dazzling whiteness. On top of the elegant, beautifully filigreed plinth was a book, a thick, leather-bound ledger, locked shut with a metal clasp. Its cover bore no title, but it was embossed with a winged blood drop, picked out in gold leaf. Next to the book was a quill and inkstand.
"I record everything,"
said Rasselas.
Every word and deed that drives the chief librarian to the brink, and at the moment I feel him straining at the bonds of sanity.
He nodded to the bloody syringe lying on the floor.
I bring him back.
Then you do have control, said Antros, looking at the empty syringe. Mephiston shook his head.
Each time it is harder to hear Gaius's call.
He leaned forwards in his chair, his eyes shifting colour to match the sapphire gleam in Rasselas's eyes.
If I gave vent to all the power I have within me, there is nothing that could bring me back. So I chain myself like a dog, always holding myself back.
He began pacing around the chamber.
But this power comes from the angel. To deny it is impossible and wrong. I must find a way to unleash his full might. I have held it at bay so long that it is starting to devour me from within.
He stopped and faced Antros, his eyes burning, his mask of serenity forgotten.
Why would the angel show me so great a destiny, but deny me the means to embrace it? What is this trial he has set me? Ultimate power within my grasp!
He clawed at the air, causing it to ripple and boil.
And I cannot use it.
He stopped pacing and stared into the middle distance, his eyes full of hope.
But now I see a chance. I have heard the same summons that haunt Sin. Someone is calling me to Divinus Prime. Something is waiting for me there. Something that will give me the answer. Something Sin thinks I am blind to. But until now, I could not give it a name.
Mephiston drew Vitaris and dragged the tip of its blade across the floor, causing a new explosion of crimson ciphers. Antros leant forwards as a shape started to form from the bloody symbols. He noticed that Rasselas was watching just as eagerly and realized that whatever Mephiston was about to reveal was news to his equerry.
Today, Lexicanium, you found the name that has eluded me.
He stared at Antros.
All these years I have searched afar for something that was so close. And now you walk into my own chambers with the name of my salvation on your lips.
Antros shook his head, mystified.
I have found no more information about the Children of the Vow.
Rasselas stared at the image emerging beneath Mephiston's sword. As he recognized the shape, his face went slack. The blood had drawn a picture of an awkward-looking sword hilt. Antros shook his head, mystified by Rasselas's awed expression. The thing looked not only ugly, but also useless. The handle was an odd, triangular shape that would be almost impossible to hold. It was like a child's idea of a sword handle.
The blade petrific,
muttered Rasselas, dropping to his knees in the blood and reaching out so his hand hovered just a few inches above the image. Mephisto nodded, his hand trembling slightly on Vitarius's hilt.
It is there, Rasselas. I hoped against hope when Antros drew my attention to Zin's use of the word vow, but I was not sure until he walked in here with that name rattling around his skull, unprompted by me. The blade petrific is on Divinus Prime, Gaius. Those half-wit priests have no inkling of what they are fighting over. They have been praying to it in secret since before the dawn of the Imperium, in complete ignorance of its true importance. They think it is a holy relic and nothing more. It is because of the blade petrific that Zin is so desperate to retrieve this world in particular. The Children of the Vow have built their whole faith around the blade. They wish to keep it secret and hidden above all else.
A sword? Asked Antros, recognizing the shape of the hilt from the illuminated letters Scholius Gore had shown him.
My lord, I do not understand. You're helping Zin reach this damned world because of a sword? Surely there are weapons in our own vaults more worthy of you. Mephiston lifted Vitaris off the floor, and the image vanished, returning the blood to a formless spiral of numbers and lines.
The blade petrific is no sword, he said. The shape is merely a coincidence. It is a machine, a device created in the dark age of technology, a neural conduit. It predates even the forming of the legions, Lexicanium. Who knows what the thing is really called? But it was born in a time of far greater understanding than ours.
Mephiston paced back and forth, disrupting the blood map that covered the floor.
It is a way to control and harness even the greatest Pyrrhic waves, he explained. A psychic lens worthy of a god.
Racilus looked dazed by the implications.
You could fully unleash the gift. You could let your mind soar.
Antros started to understand how significant this piece of archaeotech was. He thought back to the scene he had witnessed on Thermia, and considered what could have been if Mephiston's wrath had continued to grow, unabated. A psychic storm, Primarch-like in its magnificence. As he considered this, a shocking image flashed through Antros's mind. He saw the chief librarian bathed in blood, as thousands of Ecclesiarchy priests lay around him in mounds, butchered and bleeding. But it was not the corpses that shocked him. It was the things that were moving through them. Protean, mercurial creatures, forming and reforming as they gambled and slid through the gore. They were lunatic things from the darkest recesses of a nightmare. Warp fiends, giggling and shrieking as they devoured the souls of the dead. Antros sat back down heavily in his chair, and Mephiston halted to stare at him. Antros dared not meet the chief librarian's eye. The vision had filled him with an unspeakable doubt, a thought that no servant of the Librarius should ever entertain. What if the power Mephiston sought to harness did not come from Sanguinius? What if it came from another, darker source? He thought of the black flames he had seen rippling across Mephiston's arm. Mephiston remained silent, staring at Antros as the rain of blood continued pattering against his armour.
My lord, asked Antros, why have you brought me here?
It took a while for Mephiston to answer, but when he did, his voice sounded strained, as though he were struggling to maintain his usual calm demeanour.
Because I feel you in my mind, Lexicanium. I do not understand why, but I sense that you know things about me that I do not even know myself. One way or another, my trials are nearing their end. Either I control this power, or it will destroy me. I am so close to losing my mind. My sanity is besieged by shadows. What happened on Thermia shocked me, Lexicanium.
His voice faltered.
You know what was in my mind when I turned on you.
Antros felt a wave of nausea as he realized that the chief librarian had been about to kill him. Mephiston took a deep breath and looked at his left hand. It was trembling slightly, like the hand of a drunk. He did not look at Antros as he said,
Either you have come to save me, Lexicanium, or to save everyone else from me. And on Divinus Prime, I will find out which.